Okay, so let's unpack this, because usually when we sit down to do a deep dive, we're trying to add something to your brain.
Right.
You know, we stack up the facts, the history, the science, and we try to build you up. But today, I mean, if we do our job right, we might actually take something away.
Which is a very dramatic opening, but you know you are not wrong.
Specifically, we might take away you.
Yeah, we are looking at the philosophy of Jean-Paul Sartre today, specifically his rather terrifying views on the self.
And we're basing this deep dive on a really fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Helms, where he analyzes Sartre's works.
Right, primarily looking at the transcendence of the ego and his massive book, Being and Nothingness.
And just to set the stakes here,
mm-hmm.
Dr. Helms lays out a logic that basically argues the self isn't what we think it is.
Not at all.
Because I think most of us, myself included, we have this intuitive feeling that inside our heads there's a little captain of the ship.
The captain theory, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very comforting.
It is. It's my identity, right? There's a me in there, a personality, a core that stays the same whether I'm eating breakfast or driving a car or recording this deep dive.
But Sartre says, nope.
Nope. The captain is a lie.
He argues that this captain, this ego inside consciousness, is actually an illusion. It is a construction, and the reality of what we are is much stranger.
And emptier.
Much emptier. And honestly, a little more terrifying.
So the mission for this deep dive is to explore this phenomenological view of consciousness.
Yeah.
We need to figure out how, if there is no pre-existing self, we actually manage to exist at all.
Right, and what it means to create ourselves ex nihilo.
Out of nothing.
Exactly, out of nothing, moment by moment. It is a heavy concept, so we need to start with the basics. What is consciousness?
Okay, let's do it.
Because before Sartre, you had giants of philosophy like Descartes or Immanuel Kant, and they essentially viewed the self as a container.
A container. Like a box that holds my thoughts.
Precisely. They called it the transcendental ego. Think of it as a unifying core, a steady backdrop that holds all your experiences together.
Okay.
So if you see a tree, the ego is the thing inside you saying, I am seeing a tree. It's the subject doing the looking.
See, that makes total sense to me. I mean, I'm the one looking at the tree. If I pinch my arm, I feel it.
Right.
If I have childhood memory, that's my memory. It feels like there's definitely a solid container holding all that stuff.
Yeah.
How can Sartre just wave that away?
Well, he doesn't just wave it away. He redefines the mechanism. Sartre, building on the work of Edmund Husserl, argues that consciousness is nothing but intentionality.
Intentionality.
Okay.
We need to define this because in normal conversation, if I do something intentionally, it means I meant to do it. Like I intentionally ate the last cookie.
Yeah. In phenomenology, it means something very different. Intentionality means pointing to.
Pointing to.
It means that consciousness is always, always directed at an object. It's like a wind blowing outward. Consciousness isn't a box that things go into.
Oh, I see.
It's a light that shines on things. It is a meaning-giving act. It's a wind blowing towards the world.
So consciousness is just the act of pointing.
Yes. And here is the crucial part that answers your objection. If consciousness is just a wind blowing outward, then there is nothing inside the wind.
It's empty.
It is empty. It's transparent.
Okay. I'm struggling with this a bit. The wind is empty. Let's try to ground this. Dr. Helms uses a specific example from Sartre's text.
The streetcar.
Yes, streetcar, which I think really helps explain this emptiness.
The streetcar example is classic. So imagine you are running to catch a streetcar. You are late. You are sprinting. You are focused entirely on that vehicle.
Right.
In that exact moment, I want you to tell me what is in your consciousness.
The streetcar. The distance.
Mm-hmm.
The speed. Maybe the burning in my lungs.
But is there an I in your consciousness?
What do you mean?
Are you thinking, here I am a person running for this vehicle because I am late?
No, actually. If I'm really sprinting or if I'm really in the zone, like playing a video game or playing sports, I'm not thinking about me at all.
Exactly.
I'm just running.
That is the key. Sartre says, in that moment, the I has annihilated itself. You are plunged into the world of objects. Wow.
There is only the streetcar to be caught. The consciousness is purely an arrow pointing at the bus.
Hmm.
There is no captain inside the head.
There is just the act of running and the object you are chasing.
Yes.
That's wild and actually pretty relatable because we chase those flow states specifically because it feels good to lose yourself, right?
We do.
We doom scroll on social media or binge watch movies specifically to shut the eye up for a while.
You have hit on something profound there. We enjoy the annihilation of the self because the self is a burden.
Yeah.
But strictly speaking, Sartre says the self wasn't there to begin with. Consciousness is empty. It's just this mechanism of revealing the world.
So when you focus on the streetcar,
you pull it from being just a thing in itself, a hunk of metal, to being a thing for me.
Yeah.
A phenomenal object.
But you're the subject. You aren't a solid thing. You're just the wind.
You are just the wind.
Okay, but hold on. I definitely feel like I have a self. I have a personality. I have a history.
If the I isn't there when I'm running for the bus, when does it show up? Because I know it shows up eventually. When I sit down on the bus, I go, whew, I made it.
This is where it gets tricky. This brings us to the difference between unreflective consciousness, like running for the bus, and reflective consciousness.
Reflective consciousness is when I think about what I just did.
Yes. Sartre argues that the ego, the I, is not in consciousness. It is an object out in the world.
Wait, an object out in the world?
We create it by looking back at our past actions.
So the self is basically an optical illusion.
In a way, yes. Holmes uses this great image from the text. The ego appears out of the corner of the eye.
Out of the corner of the eye.
Think about it. When you stop running and you sit down, you think, I ran for the bus. Now you have created an eye to explain the action.
Okay.
But if you try to look directly at that eye, if you try to catch it, it vanishes.
Because as soon as I try to look at me, I'm just consciousness looking at something again. I can't ever catch the thing doing the looking.
Exactly.
It's like trying to bite your own teeth.
That is a very good analogy. Holmes uses a funnier one. He says the ego is like a greased pig.
A greased pig. That is not the highbrow philosophical image I was expecting.
It's vivid, isn't it? But think about the mechanics of trying to catch a slippery animal. The harder you grip, the faster it shoots out of your hand.
Right, it just slides away.
Sartre thinks your ego reacts the exact same way to introspection. As soon as you try to pin down the Salperia, you slip back into unreflective consciousness. You are just watching again.
So if I can't catch the pig, how do I build this ego that I think I have? Sartre says it's made of states and actions, right?
Correct. The ego is a construction. It's a pole or a unification of these things.
Yeah.
Let's talk about states. Sartre uses the example of hatred.
Hatred. Okay.
You might say, I am a hateful person or I hate that guy. But Sartre would ask, are you constantly feeling the active emotion of hate every single second?
No. I mean, I might be eating a sandwich or sleeping. I'm not actively hating them.
You see the gap, but you want to unify your experience. So you invent a state called hatred.
I see.
You say, this hatred exists in me like a static object to explain why you feel angry sometimes. But the hatred is a passive thing we assign to ourselves. It's a label we stick on the empty container to make it look full.
So hatred is just a story I tell myself to make sense of my momentary flashes of anger.
Precisely. And the same goes for actions. Holmes mentions examples like playing the piano driving a car or breaking wood for a fire.
Breaking wood. Very rustic.
When you chop wood, you see the wood breaking, you feel the axe, and afterwards you look back and say, I am the wood chopper.
So I create the I to be the support for the action.
Yes. The ego is just the spontaneous transcendent unification of all these things you've done.
Spontaneous transcendent unification. That's a mouthful.
It is.
But basically, we are weaving a tapestry out of our actions and calling it me.
And that tapestry is out there in the world along with the wood and the piano. It's not inside you. The inside is still just wind.
It's disorienting. If I'm just this empty wind blowing through the world and I can never actually catch myself. That creates a massive vacuum, doesn't it?
It does.
I feel like I'd be desperate for someone to tell me who I am.
You are absolutely right. And this is the perfect bridge to where Sartre gets much darker. This desperation is what fuels his massive work, Being and Nothingness.
Okay. Being and Nothingness. I've seen that book on shelves. It's about 1,000 pages and looks absolutely intimidating. What is he actually trying to say in there?
It is dense, but the core conflict is what Dr. Holmes calls the dialectic.
Whoa, pause there. Dialectic is one of those philosophy buzzwords. In Sartre's world, does that just mean conversation or is it something more specific?
Good catch. It is not just conversation. It refers to a conflict, a tension between opposing forces that drives reality.
Okay.
In this case, the tension is between the pour soi, the for itself, and the en soi, the in itself.
Yeah, okay, let's break those down.
The en soi, the in itself, is static. It's a rock, a tree, a chair. It just is. It has no consciousness. It's solid. It's full of being.
And the pour soi.
That is us. Consciousness. It's empty. It's constantly becoming. It defines itself by what it is not. It is literally nothingness.
So I am a for itself, a nothingness. Trying to navigate a world of in itself solid things.
Yes. And the problem arises when you meet another person.
Oh boy.
Because you are used to turning things into objects for you. You see a coffee cup, it becomes my coffee cup. It has meaning because you are looking at it.
Right. It's part of my movie.
But then you see another person and you try to do the same thing. You try to make them a character in your movie, an object for me.
So you try to possess them to fill your own emptiness?
Exactly.
But they're trying to do the same thing to me. They're looking at me and making me a character in their movie.
Exactly. It is not an I-thou relationship where we connect. It is an I-it relationship.
I-it. That sounds isolating.
We are both trying to turn the other into an object to solidify our own existence. That is why the look is so dangerous in Sartre. When someone looks at you, they steal your world.
This reminds me of that line, hell is other people.
That is from his play No Exit, which Holmes discusses. In the play, you have three people locked in a room. And every time one person tries to establish a self-image, tries to be something,
another person looks at them and turns them into something else.
Yes.
Like if I'm trying to be the hero, but you look at me with judgment, suddenly I'm not the hero anymore. I'm just the fool in your eyes.
Yeah.
And I can't stop you from doing that?
You cannot. You become an object in their world, and that destroys your freedom. Holmes also mentions the play The Flies.
What happens in that one?
There's a character, Orestes. He comes back to his childhood palace. He sees a door.
A door.
Just a door. Yeah. But he looks at it and says, my door. My palace. By looking at it, he claims it. He creates a relationship.
Right. He's making the world his.
And that path of claiming the world, of making it mine, leads him to eventually commit a horrific act, killing his mother. It's this desperate need to anchor ourselves in the world that drives us to conflict.
It sounds exhausting, this constant battle to define myself against others who are trying to define me.
It is very exhausting.
But wait, Dr. Holmes made a point about how we know the world is real. It isn't just this intellectual game of chess, right? It's physical.
Yes. This is one of Sartre's most famous concepts, nausea.
Nausea, like physically wanting to throw up.
It is that visceral. Descartes sat by a fire and used logic to prove he existed. I think, therefore, I am. Sartre says that's nonsense.
Because logic doesn't prove reality.
Exactly. Logic doesn't prove reality. Nausea proves reality.
How so?
In his novel, Nausea, the protagonist, Roquentin, has this moment where he is looking at the root of a chestnut tree.
Okay.
And suddenly the word root disappears. The category wood disappears. And he just sees the thing itself, the black, naughty brute existence of it.
So he sees the raw data of the world without the filter of language.
And it is terrifying. He realizes that existence is just there. It is superfluous. It is too much.
Too much.
The sheer overwhelming muchness of existence, the fact that things are there brute and silent and heavy, it makes him sick. Holmes quotes him saying, I vomit, therefore it exists.
I vomit, therefore it exists. That is a long way from, I think, therefore I am.
It proves that we are caught in this web of existence, whether we like it or not. The world doesn't care about our definitions. It just oozes existence.
So let's recap the nightmare so far.
Mm-hmm.
We have no internal self. We're just empty wind. We are constantly fighting to objectify others so we feel real.
Right.
And the world itself is a terrifying, nauseating mess of raw matter.
When you put it that way, it does sound like a nightmare.
But here's the kicker. This is where the philosophy pivots to what might be the most famous or infamous part of Sartre's work.
Yeah.
The idea of freedom.
Yes. Dreadful freedom.
It starts with the maxim, existence precedes essence. We hear that a lot on t-shirts and coffee mugs, but what does it actually mean in this context?
Think about a paper knife. Before a paper knife exists, someone has an idea of it, a blueprint.
Sure.
Its essence, its purpose, its design exists before the actual object is made.
Right. It's made to cut paper. If it doesn't cut paper, it's a bad paper knife. That's its essence.
But for humans, Sartre says, there is no creator. There is no God to have a blueprint for us.
And since there is no transcendental ego inside us, there is no human nature pre-wired into our brains.
Exactly.
So we show up first. We exist. And then we figure out what we are.
We don't just figure it out. We create it. We create our essence at every single instant.
Creation ex nihilo, out of nothing.
Yes. Because consciousness is empty, every moment is a fresh start. You are not bound by your past.
Wow.
You are constantly escaping who you were to become who you are not yet.
That sounds hopeful, actually. Like, I can reinvent myself. If I was a jerk yesterday, I don't have to be a jerk today.
It can be hopeful, but Sartre connects this to Dostoevsky. Remember the line, if God is dead, then anything is possible.
I remember that. Usually people mean it like, oh, if there's no God, there's no morality, so I can do whatever I want.
Sartre expands it. He says, if there are no universals, no fixed human nature, no core self, then literally anything is possible. And that is where the dread comes in.
It's the way to freedom. But why is it dreadful? I think total freedom is the dream.
Is it? Think about the implications. If you are totally free, it means you have no excuses.
Oh, I see.
You can't say, oh, I have a bad temper, that's just how I am. No, you are choosing to be angry right now.
Because the anger isn't the state inside a container.
Exactly. You can't say, I was raised this way or my passions drove me to it.
Because passions and past are just objects I'm looking at. They aren't controlling the wind.
Exactly. That is the past. That is dead. In this moment, you are free to do anything. You could stand up, walk out of the room, quit your job, or, as Holman puts it, blow up the universe.
That's the anxiety. It's not just I can do what I want. It's I am responsible for everything I do.
And not just for yourself. Sartre says when you choose, you are choosing for all of humanity. You are defining what a human being is by your actions. That is a crushing weight.
I'm driving the car, but there are no rails, no map.
Yes.
And the steering wheel is disconnected from anything solid.
And you cannot blame the map because you are drawing the map as you sail. We are tireless creators of our own existence. We are condemned to be free.
Condemned to be free. That is such a paradox. But it fits everything we've talked about.
It really does.
If there's no captain in the ship, then I am the ship, the ocean and the wind all at once deciding where to go every second.
It removes all alibis. You are not just the way you are. You are what you do next.
So let's try to bring this all together. It feels like we've dismantled the human being and put it back together in a very strange shape.
Yeah.
What is the synthesis here?
The picture Sartre paints is this. You are not a solid object. You are a wind of consciousness blowing through the world. You have no internal definition.
Okay.
You create an ego in your wake, a trail of actions and states that you look back on and call me.
And you're engaged in a constant struggle with others trying to solidify yourself while they try to solidify you.
Yes.
And underneath it all is this absolute terrifying responsibility.
It is the ultimate anti-complacency philosophy. It demands that you actively create me every morning.
And every afternoon. And every evening. It never stops until you die. Then finally, you become an in itself.
You become your history.
But as long as you are alive, you are an open question.
Which is both a liberation and a burden.
Well, on that note, here is a final thought for you listening. We usually like to end with something provocative, and today I think it's this concept of dreadful freedom.
It raises a fascinating question for our daily lives.
If you are creating yourself from nothing right now, if the past doesn't actually bind you, is that total possibility a gift?
Is it the ultimate freedom?
Or is it a burden too heavy for anyone to actually want to carry?
Do you want to be the captain, or do you secretly wish there was a course already set for you?
Something to think about the next time you're running for a streetcar or just trying to get out of bed.
Mm.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. We'll see you next time.